Thanks for downloading this podcast. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy wherever they get their podcasts. This is RS1, part of the Radio Show Limited Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome along to a special programme on the Radio Show Limited Network of audio and visual channels. I'm John Hindove, and in this show, we'll be looking at the 2023 FIA Formula One World Championship. The good news is you won't have to listen to my ranting, raving, musings, or anything else, good, bad, or indifferent. Well, at least not just mine, because I'm joined by not one, but two experts to gaze back at the 2023 season. Of course, it would not be Formula One here on RSL without our very own Formula One correspondent, Nick Damon.
Hooray! The season's finally over!
And joining us for the first time on one of these review programmes, another Formula One titan, a giant of the sport, the man whose voice has accompanied every single minute of Formula One action in the Middle East region, and that is Phil Anson. Phil, thanks for being with us, and your thoughts, first of all, on the season as a whole.
Well, hello, John. Hello, Nick. Hello, everyone. It's been a season, John. It's of highs and lows, and I'm going to use every adjective I can at the moment. But yes, it's been a season of singular dominance, as we all have witnessed. And in history, we'll go down saying that it is one of the most dominant racing seasons that from one driver and one team that we've seen in a very, very long time, since the start of the modern Formula One in 1950. So, yeah, that aside, there has been some very good things coming out of it. There has been some things that we're going to discuss this evening in regards to how the season progressed and teams going forward and backwards. But overall, and yes, we covered every session, every free practice session. We talked with the teams, we talked with the players, and I'm happy to impart some of that that to you this evening.
Excellent. Excellent. Let's cast our mind back to the start of the year, which seems an inordinately long time ago. Qatar, back on the calendar, Nick, after last being held in 2021. Initially meant to be going to a new track, but Lazelle was revamped, refurbished. Actually, that almost doesn't seem a big enough description of all the work that went on there. And that took place. And the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix stayed at Jeddah on the Corniche circuit. Debut for Las Vegas on the street track at the Strip. And Russian Grand Prix, of course, was going to be moved from Sochi to a new Igora Drive circuit, about 54 kilometres from St. Pete in Florida. That might have been easier. Of course, that didn't happen because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We didn't get the French Grand Prix. We didn't get the Chinese Grand Prix, cancelled for the fourth consecutive year. And the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix was cancelled due to flooding in the area. And yet we still had 22 Grand Prix, which, I'm sorry, I'm going to say this right out, too many.
I don't think anyone can disagree with you who's got a sensible opinion. Yeah, I think the calendar itself, and I think the new races and the revised races, the actual races themselves as a functional methodology of getting cars around a track to the end, were all pretty good. I don't think we saw any real major problems apart from the manhole cover or water hydrant cover in Vegas. I think, if we cast our mind back to the beginning of the season, well, unfortunately, a week before the season started, we already knew who was going to win. It was a unique combination of one team doing an excellent job and their two greatest rivals both simultaneously dropping the ball from a position where they could have challenged. So it's as much Mercedes and Ferrari's failure as Red Bull's success we've seen in domination.
Can you remember, gentlemen, if you cast your mind back, what was the major changes to technical regulations? Porpoising the up and down movement that was supposed to have been addressed with diffuser heights and ride heights and floor edges, a slightly different roll hoop design. Mirrors were made bigger again. Weights and temperatures, and so we got down to 796 kilos for the car. That was down by all of a good visit to the lavatory, 2 kilos. Slot gap separators, remember those? We were talking about those at the start of the season as well. Oh, dear me. Then we had some slightly different sporting regulations. Pirelli changed the tyre compounds. And, of course, the sprint events. 6 Grand Prix had sprints compared to 3 in the previous 2 years. And basically, I want to start with, this is the big talking point as far as I'm concerned. And Nick, you said on Midweek Motorsport and your team by team that you're not sure it's working. At the end of the season, when we were talking about the FIA and the discussion points for sprint, my contention is, if it takes you so long to discuss this, then it's probably not working. Phil, you come at it from a different angle, because as a broadcaster to an audience that is, broadly speaking, a mixed audience of diehard fans and people in your region, the Middle East, who are coming to Formula One in a fairly new capacity. Sprint weekends, how do they go down for you? How do you think it's worked?
Our overall response, John, has been they like it here.
Mm.
We have one practice session. Everything else after that is either qualifying or racing. Okay, yeah. So that I would, and our majority of our audience, and we put the question out to them, and they would rather do that than watch 3 1-hour practice sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because
it counts for something.
It does. It counts for something, and it's also when we have competition on track. Okay, and I think that's the key thing, that as soon as you put people in a competitive mode, then it changes the dynamic. Okay, we have lots of talk about it's diffusing the Formula One genealogy of just that one race and whatever. And I think with the talks that are possibly going on, that it may separate out from that.
Ooh.
Okay, which may be a standalone sprint championship. We want something else to happen in there as well. Damien, the lead commentator on SSC2, we're obviously talking about something completely different, of having an avenue for the reserve drivers to compete.
Yeah.
Okay, having a T car, the third car. You know, these sort of things can be bought into that if you take it away from the main game. And that's something that we've been discussing.
I'll ask you another question about this in a moment. But Nick, for those who don't know, we've had lots of discussions, as I said, about this. I think your primary issue with this is not whether the sprint happens. The sprint happens. Just the way in which it affects, probably inordinately affects and affects the rest of the weekend too much, because once you've set the car up for the sprint, it's effectively park fermé, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the problem is that in a sprint weekend as configured for the 2023 season, you have 1 hour of practice, then you decided what your setup was going to be, you took that into qualifying for the Grand Prix, you took that into super qualifying, what they called it, I can't remember, for the sprint race, and you took it to the sprint, and then you had the same setup. There's a man who knows, he's a broadcaster.
He said it a lot this year.
Yeah. And the problem was, we saw how bad this was by the number of cars that ended up starting the main race from the pit lane, because they had a setup that was not serviceable for the race. We saw it in Baku, we saw 4 cars start the pit lane in Kota because they had the wrong setup. They had to go wear the plank out, and we saw that. Obviously,
2 DQs.
And then they had 2 DQs obviously in Kota because they hadn't got the running time. So it seems to me that you're it's baby with the bathwater thing. You want this sprint to work, and we can, it's interesting what Phil said, and we have to realise I come at it from a purist point of view, whereas Phil comes from it from normal people who are coming to F1 and like to see more things happen. If it's completely separate, then I'm much happier with it than when it's influencing the main race.
Yeah, no, and I get that. The acid test, Phil, is do the viewers like it? And you guys track, you guys can track quite closely how many people are watching your coverage. So what do you know from a sprint weekend versus a normal 3FP qualifying and race weekend?
35% more.
Really?
Yep. 35% more hits on that red button.
Wow.
Okay, as I said, they don't want to watch cars just run around and practice, literally free practice. They're more interested in qualifying. You see drivers at 11 tenths. Racing. You've got racing. I agree with Nick. We have to get rid of this park firmer issue. Yep. That's a key to everything. Mm-hmm. If we can divorce that out, that it then becomes, we have, you know, Friday we have whatever, you know, a practice session, shootout. Then we have the sprint in the morning, and then your free half-hour warm-up session before qualifying to change your car.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to something. We used to have 90-minute sessions, remember, John?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so why not have a half-hour session after you've done the sprint? You've got 2 hours, do that, and then go into it.
All right. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it looks like it's back in some form. Yeah. Or another, it's being discussed.
The balls
are in the air. Where will they fall? So quick fire questions then. I think I know the answer from you, Nick. You would like the whole sprint divorced from the rest of the weekend. Let's get that done on a Friday, yeah?
Yeah, and I think if you have the opportunity, if you've chosen the right tracks they have, to actually get those races in a nice hour package at prime time in Europe. Which is what it's all about. It's all about views. You get it.
You say Friday, not Saturday.
Yeah, Friday night. Why not have people? If you have an early evening, probably the 7 o'clock time slot, Europe, 6 o'clock UK, or 1 hour later, still, you know, 9, 10 o'clock in this region in the UAE where we're recording this. Mm. I think that would work really well. And you can make an hour and 15-minute package. You know, here's an idea. Put it free to air.
Oh, yes. Now that's a whole different.
You've
set off another. So we'll be going into the fourth and fifth hour of this review program for the Formula One World Championship. Friday's here, of course, means something completely different. But a Friday timed into the later evening race here, how might that affect that extra 35% viewership?
When we look at it, and when we look at our red buttons that are in this region, we actually drop off on race day. Sunday's a work day.
Yeah.
We drop off on race day, Friday and Saturday, and it going through, say, the sprint shootout on a Friday evening gets, once again, 35% more than if we had free practice too.
As you can probably hear, and you might well guess, there are cars out on the track, because I don't think you're going to be able to do that. I think I was going to get very warm very quickly. But we'll give it a go. Cars out on the track. We are at Kuwait Motor Town and talking about Formula One over one of the newest circuits in this region, which is absolutely stunning. Let's move on then from the bigger picture to talking about the season as it pertains to those who took part. And in Nick's usual team-by-team style, we'll start at the back of the grid. I'm going to warn you in advance, gentlemen, that I will be asking you for your Driver of the Year, Team of the Year, and Race of the Year. Well, it's not, in Driver of the Year, you know, it could be a surprise, because I'm not necessarily saying who was the best. Who caught your eye? Who did better than you expected? Who did worse than you expected? I'm sure we'll talk about that as we go through. So rather than go, we'll go team by team, but we'll do it on the team's finishing positions as it stood at the end of the season. 10th and last, with just 12 points, Haas Ferrari. Nick Damon, an overarching comment about Haas Ferrari before we get to the drivers.
They had an intrinsic issue with the car, because it was too hard in its tyres. By a factor of two, it disappeared from every other car, which they never managed to fix. Most of their points were scored in the sprint race in Austria, where they were able to change tyres in a one-third distance race. Well done, Nico Hülkenberg. However, Hülkenberg qualified very well and showed he was worth his comeback, which people were asking at the beginning of the season. Magnussen sort of tailed off. The problem for them is there's no sign they have any idea of how they're going to fix this problem for next year. Don't forget, the rules are incredibly stagnant between this year and next year. I think probably the most similar they've ever been in the last 20 years.
Two drivers for Haas, Phil. Was there much between them? How do you rate the drivers and their performance?
Oh, look, both of them were dealing, as Nick said, with a car that was incredibly draggy and basically chewed its tyres to pieces. It was a Saturday car. That was it. It was never a Sunday car. And they couldn't. And Nick's 100% correct. We're going to agree a lot, I think, going through this. But, looking at their qualifying performance of, looking at Nico Hülkenberg, particularly, he seemed to be able to get the most out of that car, the most out of a very bad package, okay, just through his experience. Kevin Magnussen had flashes, but just couldn't keep the consistency there.
I like both of those drivers as individuals, and we've dealt with them, obviously, in sports car paddocks around the world, and, you know, where they've had great success, clearly they can drive cars. I don't think, look, it's degree, isn't it? And we will say that some people have done not as well as others. Let's remind ourselves, these are 20 of the best drivers in the world, what everybody says. You might not be the best driver in Formula One. That doesn't mean, Nick, that you're a bad driver. And finishing at the bottom of the driver point standings doesn't mean that you're not a good driver.
With the particular limitations that the Haas car had, I don't believe Max Verstappen would have finished much further up. Because it's in this current format, chewing your tyres is the absolute worst race you can have. Draggy is bad, but there are tracks where that's not a problem. Yeah. Chewing your tyres is wrong everywhere.
I never really understood how they managed to get draggy and chewy of tyre, because normally if you're draggy, the car isn't sliding so much and you don't create the surface temperature which creates the graining. So it's almost like we really got the worst of both worlds there, guys. Can we not just take this car out and burn it? People were saying that the Mercedes wasn't a good car. My God, it looked stratospheric compared to the Haas Ferrari. Nick, you mentioned the fact that regulations are incredibly similar this 2023 season through to 2024. What can they do? Is it, I mean, also within the bounds of the cost cap, it's, can they start again?
They're nowhere near the cost cap. That's one of their problems. Gene Haas isn't spending the $145 million you're allowed to spend. Their only hope, and I take this because they tried all sorts of aero changes, their only hope is they made a fundamental suspension error.
Yeah.
Which they can fix with new pickup points, and new pickup points is too big a job, as we saw from Mercedes last year, to do in season. Otherwise, they are, can't think of a clean word to say it, but ruined. Because if it's not a suspension pickup point, they have no idea how to fix this problem.
Let's move on to ninth with only 16 points, so 4 points better off than Haas Ferrari, and that is Alfa Romeo Ferrari. Two Ferrari engine teams at the bottom of the team's standings. Phil, a thought about the overall, one of the prettiest cars on the grid. I love their original livery with that darker red. I think that's a great throwback livery. Obviously, that's going to change for 2024. I even quite like their special livery at the end of the season, although it did make it, that must have been a nightmare for you. It was, looked like an AMG Mercedes. Alfa Romeo, Sauber, their two drivers. Start with the team first of all. How do you rate them?
Oh, look, yes, very pretty car. Very difficult to switch the tyres on. Valtteri Bottas managed to do it, and he managed to get that car. I think he qualified high as fourth at one stage during the season. But such a tricky car, knife-edge car, okay? And it was track-specific. There was only two tracks it worked on. Everything else, it didn't work on. It just didn't come together. The balance was all over the place. We listened to all their radio, and that was their main thing. They just couldn't get it to balance. When it got balanced, they couldn't switch the tyres on.
Yeah. Okay, so they had the opposite problem to Haas, who had too much downforce and chewing up the tyres. They had probably not enough downforce, and they couldn't switch the tyres on. Maybe they should be talking together. I feel there's a compromise situation between those two Ferrari engined cars. Look, I know I was in a minority when he was at the sharp end of the grid, but I like Valtteri Bottas. I still think he's got something to give. And on his day, and when he's motivated, I still think he's right up at the sharp end of the field in terms of his potential pace. The problem is getting him in, never mind getting the car into the operating window, it's getting Valtteri into the operating window.
I think that's a little bit harsh. I think that there is a multitude of sins in that car, and as Phil rightly said, it was track specific to very few tracks. And they actually managed to completely louse up the one track it was quick at. Was that Qatar, I think it was? But they had a fantastic qualifying, and Joe's effectively semi-stalled it on the grid and then destroyed Valtteri's pace. They had no luck, Alfa Romeo. No luck. However, they had no great strengths. Even the Haas had a strength. It was a great qualifying car. There was no strengths to that Alfa Romeo. It wasn't clinically weak anywhere, but the problem was, to get the scraps of points that were coming round, you had to have a USP that could pull you through from that bottom area, and we'll talk about the other two bottom teams and how they managed to get points. Because they didn't have it, so they just didn't even. They'd have a weekend. They'd be 12th, 13th, 13th, 14th, and that was both drivers. Going back to your point, I think Valtteri put in a number of very good performances. Yeah. He had no luck, and they were completely occluded by people running into him. He was great. Was it the last race, the penultimate race? He was brilliant. Then he was great in Vegas, and he was no fault his own. He was crashed into both the front and the back of the car. Yeah. It's like, come on. You know, I think it must be harder for Valtteri. He drove the best car in the world for 5 years and won races. But I don't think it's a motivation thing. I think it's just a car that had... It had no vices, but no virtues either.
Oh, very good.
We're at Kuwait Motor Town, and it's Phil Anson, voice of Formula 1 for TV in this region. Nick Damon, our Formula 1 correspondent, and me, John Hindhoff, as we're reviewing the 2023. For some reason, I nearly said 2021 there, and it ran through my head. I have no reason why that was.
Because it was a far more interesting season.
Yeah, well, almost. I've just blocked out the last 2 years, basically. And we're running through the teams in the FIA Formula 1 World Championship. Haas Ferrari, Alfa Romeo Ferrari at the bottom. The first non-Ferrari engine car we're going to talk about is a Honda engine car. And that is in 8th position with 25 points. AlphaTauri, Honda, RBPT, we have to talk about, Red Bull Power Team, Powertrain. But, of course, it is a Honda and it was still being looked after by Honda engineers. Well, take up that point that you were making, Nick, that the two bottom teams perhaps didn't convert the opportunities that they had, whether by bad planning, bad luck, whatever. But AlphaTauri really should be doing better than this, shouldn't they?
Well, they're effectively a one-car team for a large part of the year. Nyck de Vries never got a handle on F1, and you could go... There are a lot of people being very wise after the event about that, but I've seen Nyck de Vries in different formulas, and I'd have said it would have worked. He was the standout man at the 2022 Le Mans, what he did from jumping in. He's, you know, has the confidence to be a work Toyota driver. It just didn't work for him in that team at that time. What can you do? In that first half of the season, Yuki Tsunoda picked up the odd scrappy point here and there, but the car itself was poor. Now, interestingly, not long after they announced a closer cooperation with Red Bull, these upgrades started to turn up. Now, obviously, they were completely designed off Faenza and nowhere near Milton Keynes whatsoever. But these upgrades started to work. And towards the back end of the season, they had a much better car. And with the exception of Mexico, where Tsunoda threw away 5 or 6 points, which cost him $10 million, they maximised it. Both Ricciardo put in a couple of good performances, got points, and Tsunoda himself, who'd had actually a very good season, I think, and another growing season, proving what Franz Tost said from day one, you need 3 seasons to get your act together in F1. And at the end of the last, and he had his best race of the season in the last race, and got enough points to get more. So they actually capitalised when the car started to work. We can ask how the car suddenly started
apparently
to
run. Those upgrades were really cheap as well. They were paid for in sandwiches.
Possibly, yeah. Who knows? But yeah, it does illustrate, I think, an issue which is going to be more as we grow. As they move more of the Faenza operation to Milton Keynes, you know, is there a Chinese wall there? No. You know, and but they're going to have to, it's going to cause problems, but I think that's probably a problem for 2 years down the line or 3 years down the line, because I don't think they'll get out of the top end of the midfield anytime soon. But yeah, so I think the answer to your question is they maximised their partnership with Red Bull, and Stoner's actually pretty good.
Anything to add or discuss or disagree there, Philip?
Yeah, difficult for the team when you run four drivers on through there, all with different driving styles, and trying to put it all together on a car that's particularly not good. Daniel Ricciardo got it to drive on the nose, which he likes, towards the end of the season, but you know, it was too late then for it to do any good for the five races that he sat out. It was just, even though it had the Honda engine in it, it wasn't quick, okay? They were just, once again, carrying way too much drag on that body style.
Let's move up the grids. Williams, Mercedes, 28 points. So in the end, just 3 points. The margin between 7th and 8th. This is the first of the Mercedes, the three Mercedes-engined teams, of course. Has been a couple of years of flux.
Pain.
And pain, yes. Many years of pain.
Yes, many.
Then a change of ownership as well. The loss of Sir Frank Williams, still relatively fresh in the memory. Williams a great fan favourite, Phil. Always has been, not just in the UK, around the world, particularly for those who followed the sport for any amount of time. One of the great, you know, great success stories of the privateer team. Of course, it's not the same nowadays, and we're not saying it is. How do you rate their season as a team with 7th in the championship? I mean, they are the last of the bottom part of the grid, because from here, we're adding another nearly 100 points on before we move up the grid. How do you feel their performance went in 2023?
They had the fastest car on the grid. Literally, the fastest car with little drag on it. That thing was an absolute rocket ship. And on those tracks where it was allowed to do that, it was an absolute dynamite. And Albon got the most out of that car.
When you say fastest, you mean fastest in a straight line. Yeah, you don't necessarily...
Tracks. Okay. Yeah. Literally, it threw the anchor out and then grew another 400 kilos when it went around a corner. So it just... But that came closer together at the end of the season. We saw them starting to improve more in the cornering side of things. I think James Vowles has done a magnificent job there. He had to reset. When we spoke to him during the season, he said the culture was wrong. He had to reinvent the culture there to get a winning culture back. It started, and we saw that in the second half of that season. And they're going to be a player next year. Their car is going in the right direction. And they've been bottom for the last, three, four seasons. Yeah. So their car is going in the right direction.
That's a good point. They have been bottom for a long time. And now they're not. They're four off the bottom. They've netted themselves 28 championship points, which will give them a bit of cash as well. They've signed up for a long-term partnership with Mercedes as well, Nick. A change of culture, perhaps. Are they going in the right direction? And what did you see for them that would be some green shoots of revival or whatever it is that they would say about that?
Well, we're brutally frank. They designed another very poor car. They designed a car that's 9th fastest overall. But if we're going to go, well, hang on a second, why are they 7th? It's because they executed better than the other three teams around them.
Yeah.
They found the weekends where they could maximise. They came up with a car that was good in certain tracks. And they had Alex Albon, who drove brilliantly in a number of races and got points. I can't think of points he threw away, but I can think of points he won them.
Yeah.
Now, on the flip side, they also had the least impressive driver of the year in Logan Sargeant, who did manage to scrape a point. And they've decided to retain him, which says a little bit about the rest of the driver market more than Logan Sargeant.
And or his checks cleared.
No, I think it says more about there wasn't a viable option.
Really?
Yeah, people are either tied up. There's no X-star waiting the wings for a comeback. The current Formula 2 grid crop is either nailed onto somebody else or not particularly good, you know, and get a loaner. So they've gone, well, we've trained this guy up for a year. These cars are tricky. They're particular. Not like anything else. Let's see what happens. But, you know, that's to me is their weakness going forward. They'll design a better car in 2024 and 2023. How big the jump is, I honestly can't tell you, because as Phil says, the structural problems that James Vowles is talking about are things you need to build massive machines and wind tunnels to fix. That's what
they've had edgy cars that have had aerodynamic issues for almost as long as I can remember now. So even though there's been changes in some of those departments, it seems that somewhere there's a fundamental issue about direction or about the strategy. No, strategy is the wrong word. But the whole character of the car that they want to build.
The thing is, and if, you know, Williams have had aero deficiencies since 1998. No, seriously. Once Newey left, they've never got anywhere near it. They didn't win it with the BMW with the best engine because their chassis wasn't up to it. Their last really good years were 14 and 15, which was the start of the turbo hybrid era, because they had the Mercedes engine. The aero was still at best average. And, you know, this is the talk about the infrastructure they want to put in. It's big CFD machines. It's looking to upgrade the wind tunnel. That's what James has identified. And the reason this gradual problem has come is many, 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 many years, and probably from about 2005-06, of complete underinvestment. And you can't switch that round in a year, which is why they were the ones pushing throughout the season for capital investment to be taken off the cost cap, or an allowance being made for teams who are behind the eight ball. Now, I'm not sure, Phil might know, because he's a bit more day to day, whether that got approved or not. It was all kind of very fudgy what was allowed and not allowed. But they need to spend probably in the region of $60 or $70 million just on stuff that doesn't go into the car but makes the car or designs the car. And that's their problem. Not their management structure now, not even their drivers now. That's the issue.
Anything to add on the two drivers there? Albon getting the best and possibly a little bit more than the best out of the car. Logan Sargeant, somewhat disappointing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... what I should say here. I'm not saying that I could do any better, or probably another 20 or 30 people who are right at the top of the game could do any better. But ultimately, Logan will know, because these drivers are nothing if not self-critical. He will know he did not have the best season.
Indeed, he was so up and down this season. Rookie season in Formula One is never easy. Nyck de Vries found that out very early on in the piece. And Vowles having the fortitude to go with him again, mainly because the driver market just wasn't there to do it. And he's got a cheap driver who could possibly improve. We did see it at Vegas. We saw flashes there that things may turn around. But he needs to get a handle on the car. He struggles to explain how he wants that car set up. I hear it on the radio. Okay? That's learning. That's a learning curve between him and his engineer. It will get better because he's got Alex Albon there to help him. Okay? But he's got another chance. But I do believe rookies need 3 years in Formula One to be anywhere.
Let's jump up that 80-odd points to sixth. And this is the only French-flagged team on the Formula One grid in 2023. With apologies. Actually, I'm not going to apologise for cars going past, because this actually is really rather good. Not Formula One engines, but they sound pretty impressive. Alpine Renault on 120 points. Now, this is a tough one for me. That we've talked about those bottom four cars who are, you know, all 12, 16, 25, 28. We've got a sort of sub-Red Bull grouping. And then, right in the middle here, is Alpine Renault on 120 points. So they're 80-odd points ahead of the people behind them, but 160 behind the people ahead of them. Give me some kind of context as to where Alpine Renault were in 2023.
Well, for a start, they threw out the entire management board and started again, which was actually the race after that was the best race they had all season, which sort of goes...
That's the dead cat bounce that you get in all sports.
Exactly. But it was one of those seasons where a lot of the times I've got to think back through the race, did I mention them at all? Okay, what are they doing? They're mid-pack, they're midfield. Camera doesn't pick them up very often because they're not doing anything, unless they're banging wheels with each other. So and that did happen, and we had the arguments between the French team, you know, managing the politics inside that team is as big a battle as trying to get the car to working properly, and I think that has a flow on effect to the what's happening on track.
And we heard that even in the radio messages that we heard on the world feed, effectively, it's late in the season, it's Vegas, when they were discussing who was going to be allowed to pass and when. Alpine Renault and their drivers, Nick.
I'm going to say something which may be controversial, maybe not. They are, I think, the most disappointing and the most disappointed team of all.
Disappointing and disappointed.
Yes, because they are... Yeah, say, we built a bad car, you came second. You know, Ferrari built a bad car, you won a race, you came third. Alpine, who were going to be closer to third than we've ever been before, we're going to be on the way up, we're 100 races to win the World Championship, and nowhere. They're in no man's land, fighting no one except themselves. And with no sign of any green shoots, they've fired everybody.
289 points away from second place and third place.
You know, I found them an interesting team, only to see which one of the two French people was going to be favoured or was going to argue with the other one. Now, I'm going to see whether Phil agrees with me. I think that Gasly edged it this year. What do you think, Phil?
Yes, I agree with that one. Gasly did edge it. He had some better performances. Esteban he had opportunities and he didn't take advantage of them. And I think that is the big thing, that his mindset went away and because of his competition with Pierre. And I think that is that's something that's either going to help that team, but this year it hindered them.
I mean, there's an adage in motor racing that the first person you've got to beat is your teammate. It felt like they took that a little bit too seriously.
Not when you're in the position they're in.
Yes, correct.
Let's look at what McLaren are doing, which we'll talk about later. They're having an internecine battle, but they realise at the moment, when you're rising from fourth to third to second to first, it's more important. Also, of course, no one's fighting for wins. So they're just fighting for the better places, and it's easy to say, I'll give up third, my teammate, rather than give up first. So no, at this point, especially with the chaos above them, they should have been the tightest knit pair of French people ever to work together to pull that team up. But I just felt their egos got in the way. The problem is they hate each other. Everyone glossed over this. They genuinely don't like each other. It's not like, he's not my favourite person. They don't like each other, and that's not going to change just because they're in a racing car team together.
The changes in management, Alpine have been a strange team to work with. We've all heard the stories about partners who haven't had the contact that they were expecting. I won't delve into all of that because lots of things have been told to us in confidence. But I think the fact that what you said right at the beginning is what really has stuck with me. They've been relatively anonymous other than when there's been a bit of controversy about them. They've finished sixth. They're still a long way from third and second. Right in the middle of the grid then, Alpine Renault, and then another team that perhaps had an up and down season. Started up, certainly. Aston Martin, Mercedes, fifth position for the team from Silverstone, 280 points, so well ahead of Alpine, and effectively only 22 points behind McLaren. Mercedes in fourth, and again solidly midfield here, Nick, but flattered at the beginning of the season to deceive in the middle and then sort of redeem themselves at the end. You've got Fernando Alonso and tennis star Lance Stroll. He decided he was going to give up racing and go and play tennis in the middle of the season. That story has disappeared. I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. There's now the distraction in some respects of the Valkyrie hypercar and a potential for some complementary engineering and even potential driver driver appearances going forward. That's for the future. What about 2023?
Well, it was a season of three halves, really, wasn't it? If going into Bahrain, or did they say a couple of weeks before the Bahrain test, you told them you're going to have 280 points, you're going to be fifth, you're going to get a hat full of podiums, including second, you know, I'd have Lawrence Stroll bite marks up my arm. Eight races in, if I said you're going to be fifth, you're going to have a hat full of podiums, they're going to go, no, we're going to be second or third. And then with about five races to go, if I said, you know what, you're going to get podiums again, you said, where are we at podiums again?
Well, let me just tell you about the start of the season. Fernando, third, fourth and sixth in the sprint, third, second, sixth, second, fifth, that's up to Austria. That's one car. The other car had two retirements, in fairness. Well, that's a solid start.
That's the second best start by a country mile. That's the car that was the only car that was challenging the Red Bulls. But what happened was development happened, and three other teams outdeveloped them, and they got lost. And then they found themselves again at the end and came back a bit. So they probably ended up being, you know, track dependent. They were on a similar par to whatever was turning up this week from McLaren or Mercedes, depending. Strong start, weird middle. The positive for them is an uptick at the end, which means they've probably got an idea what they did wrong in the middle. So when they come up with next year's car, they could start...
They'll have another great start to the season.
Exactly. Yeah. And Lance Stroll had an uptick at the end. So the last three races or four races are very, very positive. The overall result, based on where they started the season, was very positive. They probably just think it could have been quite a bit better.
I've always thought Fernando Alonso, on any grid, is going to be either the best or one of the best drivers on a grid. And that still, for me, holds true in Formula One, Phil. Many, many times down through the years, he has got more out of a car. He's wrung results out of a car that the car didn't deserve to give him. That's the Alonso effect. And at the start of the year, he must have thought he was in clover with what he was getting out of that car. Stroll, on the other hand, well, unfortunately for Lance, he gets tarred with the, well, he's only there because his dad bought the team. And the brand and most of Britain or whatever it is, you know. And I think that's a little unfair, going back to my comments from earlier on. Nobody gets to Formula One without being able to drive and drive more than competently. I think Lance will take a lot from the end of the season. Alonso is Alonso. He'll do what he does. Your thoughts on those two and the team as a whole?
We saw Alonso as Alonso in Brazil.
Yeah. Yeah.
With that battle with Perez. You saw the lines he was taking out of that last corner, the way he was using the power deployment. Totally, nobody else was anywhere near that. We saw it at Yas when he pulled
into the horseshoe as well, in the middle of the lap. Yeah. Incredible stuff.
We were watching the onboard telemetry and we were going, that's not right. We were saying the telemetry's wrong, right? Because you shouldn't be doing that there. Then we saw it at Yas, where he pulled over to not get the DRS because his car was slow down the straights. He wanted DRS on Hamilton. That's why he pulled over the right near the race and drive school. We know Fernando quite well because he races at the Kartdrome and we chat with him about there. And it's true. 2/10 of what he's doing in that car is driving the car. 8/10 is thinking about what's going on around him, who's doing what. He's watching the big screen. He's watching this. He's just multi-level. Lance, on the other hand, he did have an unfortunate start to the season. He had some DNF, some whatever, not entirely his fault. So he got on the back foot. With him, we know that affects his confidence.
Yes.
Right? And it does. When we spoke
a couple of big shuns, and when he has a big shuns, he doesn't, and I use this word advisedly, he doesn't bounce back easily, does he?
No, and the shuns he had were not kind and not pretty. But we spoke with Mike Crack coming up to the summer break, and we found out what was wrong, okay? The data they were putting in the simulator, there was something wrong with it.
Ah.
Okay, and that wasn't... When they put it to the track, it wasn't working.
So the correlation wasn't
there. The correlation was out. Okay, where there should have been a one, there was a zero. Okay, literally, that was it. So that took them a while to work out where that miscorrelation was they found it with about four races to go. Then they started to come back up again, okay? They had some aero changes to the car as well, but then we saw Lance get much better on terms with the car as well, much better. Because that car, remember Alonso, 6 months beforehand, he wasn't a driver in that team. In 6 months, he webbed a whole team around him,
yeah.
And that car was built for him,
yeah.
Okay? He did a Schumacher, all right? And,
or a Prost, or any of the great drivers. Yeah.
And it was up to his teammate to learn how to drive the damn thing.
Yeah.
And that's what he did.
Stroll drove with a... didn't he drive with injury as well? Yeah, he had a broken hand. Another cycling accident. Hearing what Phil's just said then, if you're an Aston Martin fan, Aston Martin racing fan, does that give you hope for 2024 that the structure of the team has been able to isolate what was going on? Mike Crack, by the way, smashing guy, came over from BMW M, of course. I like Mike. He's an extremely down-to-earth guy. He's data-driven, but he is an enthusiast, and he will want to drag that team back to where they were at the start of this season. Does that give you hope, Nick, from that point of view?
I think if you're an Aston Martin fan, the idea that they know what was wrong and they will have a direction to move forward is great. They are not going to start next year as the second fastest team. It's not going to happen. I'm not saying that as a negative thing towards Aston Martin, but already we've seen McLaren leapfrog them in development. The Ferrari and the Mercedes are as quick or quicker with cars they are throwing out completely for new designs they believe, Red Bull designs, that they believe are going to be quicker.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what they're up against. And now, you know, two wounded behemoths and a team which is running the same engine as theirs who seems to have made a better fist of it. Now, they do have Alonso, and it was great to see Alonso this year because it's the first time in several years he had a car worth fighting with, and so he's fought with it. And it's a kind of a world champion trait. Now, you know, it's something, interestingly, that one other driver on the grid outside of Max Verstappen also demonstrated on a couple of occasions,
yes,
and you suddenly just see it's that oldest adage in sport: form is temporary, class is permanent.
Yeah.
And the class comes out sometimes, and Brazil was a great example. Some of the early season stuff that Alonso did was great. You know, he had a dip, and it's interesting that dip, when the car went away, how much does a 42-year-old two-time world champion, double Le Mans winner, want to have another race fighting a car?
Yeah.
And so you kind of went, okay, if they produce a good car he can fight with, excellent. I don't think he's got the stomach for a difficult car again, not saying they're going to build one.
No.
Okay. Let's move on to a team you mentioned there, McLaren Mercedes. So two Mercedes teams, just as I said, 20-odd points, 22 points apart. It used to be almost that I could have recorded it once and dropped it into these review programmes and the preview programmes. I cannot believe McLaren are going to have another year like this year. I cannot believe McLaren are going to have another year like last year. It has to be their year. It probably was more of their year this year. Zak Brown, he said it wasn't going to happen overnight. Gradually, the side pods, the wing end plates, the sponsorship side, which we know Zach is very good at. He doesn't have a magic Rolodex either. It's happened. It's come along with change at McLaren. And they had a car fourth in the championship this year with five podium finishes, and four of those were second places.
They had a car at the beginning of the season which was 6 months behind the development curve. That was what Zach said, and they knew it. And they had to work so hard. And when the upgrades started coming, we were seeing upgrades in hundreds and whatever. They were doing upgrades in tenths. And in Formula One parlance, that is acres of ground that they're making back. Andrea Stella did an amazing job with that team, got the drivers around him. Really lucky to pick up Piastri, who jumped into a car that Daniel Ricciardo couldn't drive, and this guy was on the podium as a rookie. I knew him in 2016 when he was here in F4. Right? He couldn't see over the steering wheel. But having somebody like that who can challenge Norris to make Norris drive better, and we saw Norris make mistakes because of the pressure he's been put under by a first-year rookie who has challenged Max Verstappen in a sprint race at Spa.
Yeah.
You know, he's got a team underneath him. If they can keep the car development going on the same curve, they're going to be a challenger.
I think McLaren's an interesting one because they've, you know, we were talking about Aston Martin potentially being sidetracked with other projects. It seems the more McLaren do, the better they get at all of them. It defies logic in racing terms in some respects. And fair play to the whole team, but particularly Zak Brown, a more than competent racer himself, let's not forget. But fair play to Zak for being able to firewall all those things and make sure that the good stuff gets passed backwards and forwards between different parts of motorsport that might not seem to be linked. But quite clearly, Nick, that is some kind of corporate governance and certainly corporate belief in their ability to go and start winning again.
Well, I think it's hard to overestimate how dysfunctional McLaren became during the end of Ron and the confusion that came through the Boulier and all the rest of the stuff. And it's sad as a British motorsport fan or a motorsport fan of McLaren. McLaren haven't won any sort of world championship since 2008. I don't think they won the constructors since 1999 or 2000. You know, we think of them as the all-conquering, all-powerful team of Senna and Prost. Well, it's, you know, perhaps Hakkinen and Coulthard. It's a long, long time ago. And they have no divine right than anyone else to succeed. They, you know, they are no longer a works engine team. It's not quite a big problem as it was. The one thing I would say, and I want to echo what Phil said, is I've been closely following F1 now since I got involved with it on a day-to-day basis in 1996. I have never seen a team upgrade a car in season like that one, ever.
Never mind within a cost cap scenario.
Never, ever seen that. That is like, and it's, well, the reason being is, in November they realised they'd made a horrendous mistake. They fired James Key, not on that day, but eventually. They made all the changes, said, what do we need to do to sort it out? They then re-looked at what was the best can we do with our one bit we're stuck with, which is the core carbon fibre chassis. Everything else can be changed effectively. And they did a job. And I'm pretty certain they were a bit surprised how well it worked. Because don't forget, because not only were they upgrading, they're upgrading against all the other teams are upgrading.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, here's our half second Ferrari and Mercedes. What are you going to do? We're going to do nothing. Have your half, you know, it was amazing. They have made an absolute coup by picking up Piastri. I think he's obviously been the stellar rookie of the last, well, 10 years, I think, given how hard these cars are to drive. It's, you know, it's probably on a par with Leclerc, which was, what, six, seven years ago. I think it's interesting that he was mature enough in his first season to see to Lando where he needed to in races. Because what I would say is, if you're going on a Saturday, there's not a lot between them for year one. But on Sunday, Lando is still noticeably superior. Now, that is the experience thing, it's tyres, and it's not to say Piastri won't be there next year. Gives me an incredibly strong team. I think that I'm going to fill again. I think Lando needs to go and have a chat with a mind management sports psychologist, because his excellence under continued pressure in a race is not reflecting his excellence in one lap pressure, and he is making mistakes, and they're so costly in this formula that we're qualifying. It can be everything.
And it counts for something now, guys, doesn't it? Because in his early years at McLaren, Lando Norris was getting a bit of a free kick because nothing was expected. And now, not only is it expected of him as the senior member of the team, but he's got this young upstart breathing up his tailpipes.
The issue comes down to, how good is Lando? How bad was Ricciardo? Because don't forget, but we didn't talk about it now for time. I'm going to ask an Australian this, but I wasn't impressed with his comeback. So was Ricciardo never that good?
He was good in a Red Bull. He could drive a Red Bull because that was a car that suited his driving style.
Yeah.
He couldn't drive a McLaren. It didn't suit his style, and they weren't going to change it for him. Mm-hmm. Okay, AlphaTauri, questions still to be answered.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You're listening to Racetrack Noise as we look back. This is Racetrack Noise. Yeah. Oh, there's a podcast title for somebody. We're at Kuwait Motor Town, and it's Nick Damon and Phil Anson. Phil's the voice of Formula One on TV in this part of the world. And we're counting down the top 10 for the Formula One World Championship for 2023, top 10 in constructors. We come to third position, and again we make a little bit of a jump, 104 points between McLaren, Mercedes and Ferrari, who are in third position. Haven't won a world title since 2007. I remember what you tell me, Nick. World Drivers' Championship, World Constructors' Championship was 2008, of course, before their dalliance with questionable engines, which then sort of put them on the back foot for a few years. Here was a team that at various stages of the season looked great, and if you just took their highlights reel, you would say, Ferrari are back, this is great, it's at their best. But then you look at the actual results. What was it, 3 podium across the season, all to Leclerc? 4 podiums, sorry, and one... Sainz. Sainz with the podiums and the race victory. I mean, just... It wasn't enough for what we saw and the potential from that car.
If, going into the season, we had no idea about Red Bull dominance, yeah, but you had told me, Ferrari are going to win one race, they're going to qualify really well, they're going to have some strategic errors, reliability errors, and Leclerc's going to have no luck, I'd have gone, yeah, okay, yeah, that sounds like their season. And that's without knowing that all bar won the race, that run race we won by Red Bull. Because the problem with the Ferrari was, nothing they did this year was any better or any worse than last year, and they've changed the entire management round. It was the same combination of unexpected reliability issues. It was the same issue of admittedly wiped more about toward the end of the season, of poor strategic errors. It was waste opportunities of pole positions. And then, you know, in fairness to them, they were the team that grabbed the one opportunity to stop the behemoth in Singapore. And I suppose in many ways, perhaps stopping the rot perhaps is a positive, but where's the springboard?
Yeah. Very good. Very good indeed. No luck for really either of the drivers, because Sainz, he didn't have any luck either at all. When he had a good car, you know, they had issues. He was, by the rules, penalised at Las Vegas. I think that will be changed, Phil. I think you're right there. He had a couple of incidents where he had accidents that other people got away with in the same sessions. He happened to hit the wall. You know, they shaved down the bump at turn 3 at Abu Dhabi after he had the accident. But it was after he'd had the accident, exactly. You know. So I'm still a big fan of both of these drivers. I think Leclerc is a good driver. I think he needs his head looking at a little bit as well, as Nick was suggesting for Lando Norris. I think Sainz still is criminally underestimated and undervalued. He has got the best hair in the paddock, and that isn't changing anytime soon. Ferrari, and particularly the two drivers.
Listening to all of the in-car radio this season, and I'm going to let you into a secret, both drivers hated that car. They absolutely hated it. It was on a knife edge the entire time. They couldn't work out where they were going to be on one corner after another from a previous lap, whether the tyres were going to be on or off. And they didn't know why. And that was their problem all season.
It was like driving a rally car. They didn't know whether they were going to have grip, not have grip.
Exactly. And they both couldn't... And it frustrated their drivers and caused them to make errors. And apart from their horrendous reliability issues they had this season, you know, having a hydraulic failure on the way to the grid, being on pole. Yeah. I mean, how many black cats and ladders and mirrors have been sacrificed at Ferrari this year?
They end up third, Nick, by just 3 points at the end. The amount of points that went awry in bizarre circumstances, they were an easy second. Was it the second best car and driver combination of the season?
No, because if you looked at the second best car, you'd have to say, which track are we at? Well, today the second best car is the Aston. Yes. Today the second best car is McLaren. Today the second best car is Mercedes. Yes. Today the second best car is the Ferrari. The reason they're as high as they are is because they didn't go poor, good like McLaren, or good, poor, goodish like Aston Martin, or let's keep changing everything and hope something works like Mercedes. And they score points the whole way through. The fact that Mercedes is ahead of them, despite constantly changing up and suffering their own stupidity and bad luck, would make you say that overall the season Mercedes is a better car. However, as a qualifying car, there was probably not even the Red Bull was as good as the Ferrari.
Sainz or Leclerc, which one's the better of the two drivers?
Oh, Leclerc.
Phil?
Same. Charles is here. Carlos just gets a bit too emotional, and that affects his driving.
Somebody said to me, sometimes he can't get out of his own way, and I kind of understand that. That leaves us with the top two. Very, very close indeed nothing at all. Mercedes, Lewis Hamilton and George Russell. Pretty good in terms of their reliability record. Just two non-finishes, two retirements there. A car, Nick, that obviously inherited the inherent deficiencies from last year. Given the cost cap situation, it is extremely difficult to make wholesale changes to a design philosophy, particularly not in season.
Given the fact they didn't know where they were supposed to be doing it most of the time, it wouldn't matter if they had $1 billion, to be honest. I mean, it's they got themselves off. The race where Red Bull made the 2023 season incredibly easy for them was the 2022 Brazilian Grand Prix, where Red Bull dropped the ball setup-wise, Mercedes won the race and suddenly thought they had a great car. And then decide they're going to develop this concept. If they'd had a wipeout in that Brazilian race, they'd have junked that thing in the bin earlier. I've forgotten the name of the guy who was the technical director, who's been replaced now by James Allison. And what Allison is saying now is obviously things have gone horribly awry in the two or three years where he wasn't in charge. And he's trying to put them right now. And if you look at what they're throwing at the car during the season, you know, it was... They're effectively saying, right, this concept doesn't work. If we hybridise it to where you want to go, what part of the hybrid works? They're effectively running a test car.
And when you say hybrid, you don't mean the hybrid drive system. You mean a mishmash of different philosophies.
It's a frustrating thing. It's frustrating for the drivers. You know, they had a couple of real flashes of pace, and that gave false hope. And they had a couple of passages of races where it's absolutely terrible, and that gave false depression. The fact was, the car was, you know, in the scheme of things, not bad. Wasn't particularly easy. It's unstable on the rear, which unnerves most drivers. You don't know what's going to do when you chuck it in. It's not very nice. When it worked, you know, the drivers were able to capitalise on it, you know, and if it hadn't been for that, there was a, you know, all-conquering Red Bull in front, they got a number of second places, which would have been first. You know, it is the way it is. I think the interesting thing was that Hamilton was noticeably superior to George this year, whereas it was a kind of a toss-up last year. It was also interesting, I think Hamilton kind of got bored with the season the last two or three races, which is actually oddly what he used to do when he won the World Championship. He used to get a bit bored the last couple of races. My standout moment of Mercedes was in the Singapore Grand Prix, when they made that late stop and Hamilton came out 7 or 8 seconds behind Russell with the potential, if he could get past all of them in certain amounts, he could win, and Verstappen was out. So it was a chance to win. And the body language of that car was so noticeably different from anything else, down to the fact that he was careful on the first lap, brought the tyres in, and then exploded onto the whole thing, forced George into a mistake, didn't have enough laps to get past the other two. And he went, oh, it's still there.
Yeah.
Where it needs to be.
When hammer time is needed, he can still do it.
And it's no example with the Alonso thing. It's, you know, form is temporary, class is permanent. If they give him a car next year, then he will be able to exit. My worry is, can he take another year of mediocrity?
Yeah, good point. And we were saying on Midweek Motorsport, when Lewis decides that F1 isn't going to be where he's been, he's not going to go to another part of motorsport. Nick was saying that Hamilton outperformed Russell this year. In qualifying, it was 11-11. And in fact, it was the only qualifying battle that went down to the wire at the last race at Abu Dhabi. So you could say that in qualifying it was fairly even. I agree with Nick, though. I have to say, I think Hamilton comprehensively outraced Russell, and to a certain extent, I won't say George was found out, because that's an awful thing to say, but he did seem to succumb to pressure more than I expected him to. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, it was an interesting one. I'm only going to speak about that when we started with the B-spec car, okay, because that's when the season started to turn around for them, okay, which was a car much more to Lewis's liking, okay. I've never heard Lewis so frustrated on the radio in the last five seasons I've been doing Formula One as I've heard him being frustrated this season. Okay, he just couldn't get that car to do what he wanted it to do, right? And when he pushed it to try and do what it wanted, the car wasn't there for him.
And the thing is about that, Phil, and that's interesting you say that, because we get little snatches of that. Obviously, you get to hear it all. It's not dissimilar to the Ferrari thing, where it wasn't the fact that they just didn't like that. They couldn't understand why it was doing what it was doing.
You saw all of his interviews after the races, and a lot of it was, I don't know. And he was 100% correct. He didn't know. Bono didn't know. And what happened during those times, and I've got to say this again, that was a very track-specific car.
Yeah.
Okay? It was inherently draggy. Okay? They just couldn't get rid of that inherent drag that car had. It was unbelievably good on its tyres. Okay? When we had a hot race or whatever, it used to outperform everybody else because it could go five laps more at a respectable lap time. Okay? Go to a cold race and all of a sudden they're in a lot of trouble. Las Vegas qualifying. Whoa, where are we going to be? We got no temperature in the tyres. So yeah, very track specific car, but Lewis did in the second half of that season get more out of that car than George did. And then I heard George getting frustrated on the radio, okay, because it wasn't the car he wanted.
In terms of the two drivers then, Nick, again, a phrase I don't like, but was George putting himself under too much pressure? Had he believed his own hype? Because, I mean, if you'd listened to people last year, Lewis was a spent force. It was all done. You know, every time that George either out-qualified him or finished above him in a race, it was, why is this old bloke basically blocking a seat when it should be some young charger there? This is Russell's team now. Well, I'm not hearing anybody saying that the other way around this year. So there's some... hypocrisy for me. How do you view that partnership and the performance of the two drivers?
The first thing I would say is don't listen to what people say, because the toxicity in the F1 fan base...
I'm sorry, what were you saying there, Nick?
Exactly, yeah. the toxicity in the F1 fan base is unbelievable. Yes. And a lot of people want nothing more than to see Lewis fail. For whatever reason it may be. It may be because they didn't like what happened in 21 with Verstappen, or it may well be because they don't like other elements of his makeup. But a lot of them want him to fail, and therefore they were seizing on the fact that George did very, very well at the start of last season and had a bit more luck. I think that at the end of the day, George Russell is a one-time race winner and Lewis Hamilton's won 103. Lewis is a seven-time world champion and George isn't. That's nothing against George. He hasn't had a chance to win a world championship.
Yes, fair point.
But again, if the car's there, I know who I'd have in the car. That doesn't mean that next year or year's time or 2 years' time it's not going to be George. He's in a different part of his career. He's done a few more years in F1, so 3 years in Williams makes him seem more experienced. I think, you know, he didn't learn. I don't think he got 3 years of learning being down there. So he's still coming up. He's in second year. He needs to push on, absolutely. He'll be, as he said, disappointed with his season. He was a bit kind of, oh, you know, woe is me in the last race. The worst season. No, it wasn't the worst season ever. He just had a couple of bad runs. He shouldn't have crashed in Montreal and he shouldn't have crashed in Singapore. But, you know, it's still a good driver lineup. And let's be honest, if Haas and Toro Rosso can't find a better driver, they're not going to find better drivers than Mercedes, are they, knocking about? So, you know, it's a good lineup. Possibly, you know, I think most of us would say that was the best lineup in F1 at the beginning of this season.
Most balanced and most not likely to score points.
Yeah, I'm not sure we'd say that at the beginning of next year. I think we might be looking more at the McLaren lineup, to be honest. But, you know, it's still very strong.
I mean, we've been talking about the Constructors' Championship, I mean, and taking the drivers as they've come with that. If we have a look at the Drivers' Championship, before we talk about the pairing of Max Verstappen and Sergio Perez, who were first and second, Lewis Hamilton third, Fernando Alonso fourth, Fernando Alonso Charles Leclerc, Lando Norris in sixth position, but only a point behind Leclerc. Is that right? That's not up to date, is it? Yes, it is, yeah. And then Carlos Sainz, George Russell in eighth position, Oscar Piastri, great first season for him, and Lance Stroll in 10th. So that sort of underlines and gives some context to what the guys were saying when we were talking about the drivers as we went through the teams. So that's it. That's our look at the Formula One.
Nobody else is on track. Thanks for
It has been, whatever you think of the individuals, the personalities of the people concerned, it has been a banner season for Red Bull Racing. And they have almost had the perfect season, Phil. And when it comes down to it, they've managed to win the World Drivers' Championship and the Teams' Championship, where Max Verstappen has scored twice as many points as anybody else, including his own teammate who came second. Somebody said, well, he would have won the World Championship on his own, even if there'd only been running one car. I mean, statistically, yes, he would have done. That has happened in the past a number of times. In terms of what they achieved, there wasn't much more for the many boxes to tick except for that one race they didn't win.
Yes. What can you say? I mean, we've witnessed a greatness. We've witnessed history. Everybody's going, you know, other teams are saying, oh, look, it's unfair, they're so good and whatever. No, they're better than you. You need to improve. Okay. There was talk about, okay, what is the FIA going to do to nobble them, to bring them back to the field? That's not how Formula One works. They just build a better mousetrap.
Well,
I'm just saying, under current management, that's not how Formula One works. All right, but they just build a better mousetrap, okay, than everybody else. And everybody else has been struggling to catch up. And next season, we're going to see more Red Bullish-like cars on the grid, just because everybody just gravitates to what is the best out there.
When we discussed the start of this season, and we'll make this point again, the regulations haven't changed a huge amount, but the Red Bull advantage still, quite aside from having Max Verstappen in the car, Adrian Newey is still the best at what he does. And if you've got a formula that is in any way, shape or form aero-dependent, then you're going to do well. There were changes made this year to try and get cars to follow closer. It absolutely didn't work, even though the outwash from the front wheels was supposed to be controlled. It didn't work. Newey in particular got his head around that. He sees air, doesn't he? They could take their CFD away because it doesn't matter. They could take it away completely because Newey sees air moving in a way that other people just doesn't. He could look at a flat surface and know instinctively what that was going to do at a 5 degree yaw, at an 8 degree yaw, at an 8.2 degree yaw. That is the genius of the man. Whatever anybody thinks about Verstappen, Nick, what impressed me, there's a lot of things that don't impress me about Verstappen. What did impress me was his complete and utter focus right the way through to the end of the season. He could have packed up and gone on holiday with, what, 3-4 races to go. He didn't. And not only did he continue to turn up, he didn't just phone it in either. He was still wanting to win races, and in his inimitable way, which sometimes is a bit whingy and a bit moany and a bit complainy, making sure he had the advantage.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to say. I think, yeah, the point about it is what Red Bull have achieved isn't Max Verstappen. It's not Adrian Newey. It's not Sergio Perez. It's a team of several hundred people, because there's somebody out there who's making sure every hydraulic fluid union is 100% correct and will work every single time. There's somebody there making sure that they're installing every, because don't forget they had no reliability issues.
No.
You know, the car,
one retirement in the whole season, and that was a crash, wasn't it?
So it's a fantastic, yeah, and the team doing the pit stop, they did a fantastic job across the line. The problem is with this, I'm not, this isn't the question you've asked me, it's the question I want to answer.
Yeah.
The problem with this season is that Sergio Perez was rubbish. Now, I remember...
Relatively speaking.
Sergio Perez was rubbish given the tools he was given.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
I remember, I think, after he won his second race, I can't remember, it was Baku, the press was going, oh, he's going to be the world champion. I said on the show, he is never going to challenge the world championship. Max Verstappen will win this at the canter. Admittedly, it was more cantery, more gallopy than I expected. This season was, as Phil rightly says, record-breaking and everything else will never go down as a classic as other total domination seasons like 1988 and 2016 did, because we had an internecine battle. We had Senna v Prost. We had Rosberg v Hamilton. We never knew what was going on. There was needle. There was nasty. It was horrible. They would literally have killed each other out of the car. That didn't matter.
Nobody's making the Verstappen versus Perez movie, are they?
Well, it'd be a short, wouldn't it? It'd be about 2 minutes. And I think it comes in that, you know, there is someone like Verstappen is not the most magnanimous of people in winning. He's hard to warm to if you're not from the Low Countries. And I think I said in the show last week, I'm waiting for him to mature like a lot of the other people did. You know, Vettel was quite obnoxious when he was young. Jenson Button was quite obnoxious when he was young, and they've turned into fantastic human beings. So I'm just waiting for that to happen with Verstappen, so we can start to like him. Because it's important as a fan to like the drivers. Do I haven't? It's nothing jingoist, because I think people like Charles and Carlos are great guys, and they But that's
does he have to go away and come back? Does he have to go and do something else? I mean, you made this point on Midweek Motorsport recently. When Verstappen's not in the car, he's in a virtual car. He's taken part in long distance endurance team races on iRacing and various other things. He has his own virtual racing squad. He's
got a sim in his plane.
He's got a sim in his plane. Yes,
that wasn't true.
And it's not Microsoft Flight Sim. Does he have to go away and do something else?
He doesn't have to do anything to appease us.
No, to find that difference in his character that you mentioned for Vettel for Jensen and for other people.
That happens with maturity and happens with age. He's still very young, even though he's been around forever. He's like 27. The thing is, and he doesn't have to do any of this. He doesn't have to make me a 58-year-old bloke from Milton Keynes like him, because he is already one of the all-time greats. Where he ends up is always going to be conjecture. You know, he's going to win next year's World Championship, I'll say it right now. Because that's what will happen. But, you know, hopefully it'll be a lot closer. And he's a fantastic racing driver. He didn't make any mistakes in the season. Now, he wasn't under much pressure, but he made no mistakes.
But when he is under pressure, Phil, and we've seen this, when the racing is getting tight, then there's contact. And he likes to muscle his way through. He likes to put his side on the radio. I think some of the calls that he's had go his way this year have been unfathomable, if I'm honest, and that's not me being biased towards him. But there is still that element of that lack of maturity that Nick is alluding to there, which, given that he's done a billion Grand Prix and he's now a multiple world champion, he should be past that now.
He's been leading by so much all season that when he gets into a race, he asks, what do I have to do now?
He's forgotten about it.
Oh, hello. What are you doing there? Let's take me back to my first season. Biffo, bango, and there we go. And we're going to just, you know, and carry on again. He will mature. And, you know, it's a very simple thing. He will mature. But over the course of time, but talking to him, he doesn't care.
No.
That's his whole thing. He just doesn't care. That's what people think, what the crowd booing him, all of that sort of stuff. If anything, it actually eggs him on, right? He's just has a different mental approach to things. And we see this with people who are so singularly focused.
Yeah, totally agree.
Totally agree with you. I mean, interesting comments about him wanting to go and do some other forms of racing. He is so singularly focused right now on Formula One and racing. I think if he put his mind to going sports car racing, and he's been talking about doing stuff with Fernando, who he seems to get on quite well with, actually, which is interesting. But I think that's probably because Fernando in his earlier years was something quite similar.
I think you finally got a common nemesis.
Oh yes. Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Very good point. Perez, as we said, somewhat underperformed, but his seat's safe. They're not going to
give that the championship. Exactly. You know, he came second in the championship, but yes, I have to unfortunately agree with Nick again that it was one of those things that he had opportunities to show something. He failed to rise to the occasion, and he succumbed to his own internal pressure. And I think that's one thing, and a lot of people we've been talking about this off air, to say that he really needs to go and see somebody and get it sorted out, because he let, you know, I'm going to beat Max.
Is it stereotypical, though, to say that that is the kind of difference when you look at those two, the sort of more laid back Netherlands national psyche until he's riled up, and then Max can lose his rag fairly quickly. And some of the radio messages this year have been absolute gold between the pit wall and him. And the, you know, you would say, and again, this is national stereotypes perhaps, but the slightly more highly strung, the slightly more passionate, red hot blooded Latin temperament of Sergio Perez.
Yeah, I think you called it there, John. It is. We're dealing with different psyche. Yeah. We're dealing with different cultural psyche there. And getting the best out of any cultural psyche is really, really difficult. You have somebody like Oscar Piastri, who looks, seriously, he radioed messages, looks like he's just woken up. The guy has no emotion whatsoever in the car. He's so laid back, but performs at an incredibly high level. Mm-hmm. Perez is the polar opposite of that. Yeah. You know, once he starts getting stressed.
I would say that we've seen and heard in Max a little bit more of his more playful side. Yeah. Now, you know, the championship was won early.
Stop singing.
And he shouldn't be singing in the car, Nick. That's down to you quite clearly. All right, so records broken, more Grand Prix, more laps led, more, because obviously there's more Grand Prix again. Let's wrap up with a couple of quick questions for both of you. So here's the easy one: driver of the year, Nick.
Well, I was torn really between Logan Sargeant and Max Verstappen, but Max just edged him.
Mm-hmm. Max,
yeah.
Okay, I think we all agree that rookie of the year would be Piastri, and rookie of the year for quite some time. Yeah. For the last 7 or 8 years, he would have been rookie of the year with that particular performance. Car of the year, I'll give this one to you first, Phil.
Not stating the obvious, but to me, the McLaren, what they did with that car in that second half of the season, nobody has done for many years.
Okay. Stating the obvious, the Red Bull.
Right. Okay.
I respect what you're saying there.
Team of the year for me would be McLaren, from what they did.
Team of the year is Red Bull.
Team of the year is Red Bull. You can't win all bar one of the races without the whole team working brilliantly.
Yeah, fair point.
The team is the whole point about that. That's not Max or Sergio or Christian or Adrian, it's everybody.
Race of the year?
Oh, that's a good question. Do you know, honestly, I there's nothing that really stands out. I mean, there's some recency bias, but I don't. There were less. Also, and you're going to probably deny, I thought there were less poor races this year, despite the fact we knew who won. Perhaps because we knew who won, we concentrated on the things that were interesting elsewhere.
I think I fell asleep less during this year's Grand Prix. So
I wasn't allowed to.
Left that to your viewers and listeners before anybody else says it. I'm only kidding. Race of the year for you, Phil. You saw every moment of every session.
I loved Vegas. Slippery track. Nobody knew it.
Yeah.
Just low grip. Evened up the cars a little bit, and nobody knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
Okay. For me, new track. Just did it all.
Yeah, I used to say for just add water for excitement in Formula One, but that was the same thing, low grip.
One thing I'll say about Race of the Year, the race I look most forward to on Saturday evening was Singapore, because I knew that Red Bull weren't going to win.
Really?
That was just like, thank goodness something different is going to happen. Doesn't make it the best race of the year, but it made the most anticipated.
Right.
I'm going to throw a couple of quickies at you that I didn't give you fair warning of. most surprising thing positive?
For me, it was, I have to say, at Williams.
Really?
I really liked that they got something out of this season.
Most surprising thing negative?
Alpine.
Nick? Positive?
Actually,
go on, you've already started.
Reliability. How many, you know how we had 10,000 engine penalties last year? This year, I think we had about three, and one of those because someone had sent a hydraulic, you know, thing through the car. Suddenly, people weren't taking extra engine units, and isn't it the same engine as last year? Like, why is it, where has this reliability come from?
Well, we got to the end five races, and only Lando had a turbocharged MGUK and MGUH in the bank. Everybody else was on penalties. With five races to go last season, I had 10 cars starting in the pit lane.
Yeah.
Okay, because so yes, reliability, and just following on the worst thing as well. Is the teams getting on top of the aero of the car following behind. Daniel Ricciardo said something really impressive. He got out of McLaren, was out of the car for 6 months. When he came back, one of the first things he said to us, it's a lot harder to follow behind.
Yeah.
Okay? It's gone from 20. Yeah. It's gone from 38 metres down to, you know, 20 metres now to 38 metres. Yeah.
And that was me, the biggest disappointment for me, was that all the changes that were made to supposedly let the cars follow closer actually had completely the opposite effect. Your biggest disappointment, Nick?
My biggest negative is the obvious beginnings and middle part of a new FIA versus FOM war that's happening. Bin Silliman is a disaster. I'm not saying that Liberty are all good, but this is not a situation that's looking anything other than going to come very unhealthy, very much more unhealthy, very much quicker.
All I would say is that the FIA want to cap the number of races and bring in more teams. Liberty want to add races and keep it at 10. I'm not sure which side of the fence I would fall on. We've run out of time, so we don't even have time to talk about the whole Andretti saga. And so I'm going to ask both of you, will Andretti be allowed in by the teams?
Yes.
I want to say yes.
But?
I expect it'll be no.
There you go. That's an interesting one to finish on. Thanks very much to Phil Anson, the voice of Formula One here in the Middle East, and our Formula One correspondent at Midweek Motorsport on RSL, Nick Damon. I'm John Hindhoff. Once again, in season 2024, there will be excitement, there will be hype, there will be passion from the very first moment that the cars roll out for that original test, pre-season test session. It'll be the best season that we can look forward to. Ferrari are in with a chance, McLaren are in with a chance, Mercedes are really quick. And then Nick Damon's telling us that Max Verstappen is going to walk away with the championship again. He's spoiled it for us already. Thank you very much for listening, and stay tuned to Midweek Motorsport for Nick's Team by Team, the best place to keep up with everything Formula One. That was 2023's FIA Formula One World Championship from here at Kuwait Motor Town.
This programme is a Radio Show Limited production.
Tell your friends there's more at RadioLeMans.com.